I was actually sent here to introduce Bill Buxton, which is kind of ironic because I'm coming into the introduction. So all I'm going to say is Bill's going to spend some time with you guys just answering questions. I think anything's fair game. I've seen Bill field all sorts of weird questions really well. So get it all out right now. The only request I have is just make sure you talk into the microphone so everyone can get a question. If you don't, then you're going to repeat the question. All right, so Bill Buxton.
That was smooth. Did he even hit something that's not too bad?
Put it closer to your mouth.
I'll put it closer to my mouth. Let me turn the volume down. Yeah, great. Even more. That's better, right? Less quick. So, I can talk for hours about anything if you want. I don't know about ice climbing or something like that, but I'm happy to. I'd rather let you drive the conversation. That makes sense.
So, how's it going?
Cool. Good.
Thanks for having a chat with us. I wanted to ask you a bit about some of what's new in Expression Blend. Because obviously they've got a lot to channel ideas from your work. Can you hear me? So they did a lot to channel ideas from your work about sketching and the concepts in the book. But one of the things that really took that from your book was traditional styles of sketching and going beyond the computer was really an important part of what we should take away from the idea of sketching and experience. So I wanted to ask, sort of, how do you see what's new in Blend fitting into this the tool set that someone should use when they're sketching?
So I think the two most important messages I would say around the question are that when we're designing, the representation we use has a huge impact on the effectiveness of the communication and whatever our intent was. And in the past, we've had a very limited palette of ways to represent our work in the digital interaction. And so anything that extends that vocabulary is useful. But the problem is to know when to use what notation, when to use what representation. It's exactly like with math, right? If you tried to do geometry with the wrong mathematical notation, with Boolean algebra, you're going to have a problem. But if you are doing logic, then Boolean algebra is fine. So I've used something like Sketchflow coming into our world. Very similar to, like, I think it was in the 50s or 60s that markers came into the industrial design studio. And they didn't replace pencil or clay or other techniques. They just added another color into our palette, so to speak. And so the thing I feel the most strongly about is that thou shalt not convey a degree of refinement of your thought or a degree of completion of a project by your representation that exceeds where you really are. And one of the biggest mistakes I've seen designers do is they immediately jump into something like, whether it's PowerPoint, Photoshop, or Illustrator, and they do these things that are really hard and look like these wonderful photo, almost like the real finished artwork for the finished product, when they haven't even made up their mind about anything about it, and they start right off with these sort of high fidelity renderings. Now, if you look at, and that's just wrong. You can do that once a day, I'll coach you, and if you do it again, you might find yourself in another position. Because as soon as you do that, you convey to your management that you're finished. And they say, that's great, ship it. The engineers see it, they say, they'll start to build it. And even if you have sketches and you just show the screenshots, they'll build it, they'll build just what you did. You say, you know, I'm not supposed to move that way. Well, you didn't tell me. It's too late. Can't go back to this. And so how we choose to represent is really, really important, and knowing who we're representing too. And that's, so, you know, in my talk yesterday, I used this font, and I noticed in the Twitter sphere that somebody was saying, hey, did he draw that hand, or is that typeset? No, that's a font. And it's a font that the Sketchflow folks commissioned and had done custom just so that you can do stuff quickly, get the text in there, but it conveys the visual language that this is something just knocked off, it's temporary, it's not permanent, so nobody's going to hold you to what is written. Right? They know it's temporary because it's just quote-unquote you've got the efficiency of the machine. And it's the same way in examples where things are just hand-drawn. So that's all fine. There's lots of things where Sketchflow is the worst tool in the world to use, right? But it's because everything, if it's any good, everything is best for something and worse for something else. And the challenge is for all of us is to know when is it best, when is it worst, and what to use for whom, when. And that's why I have a hate on for technologies that, as powerful as they are, if they're too complex, they force you to become good at it. It takes so much time that it's at the exclusion of the other techniques that you need to have in your repertoire. And so I always go for simplicity, because I'd rather have 10 different techniques that I can render something in, so I can choose, rather than be, what was it, Alias, if you were a master of Maya or Auto Studio. That was a full-time job, so it didn't matter what you were rendering, it was done in Maya now, because that's something you had to do. And that's wrong. I think that some of the tools you've had in the past, Director got that, Flash got that. We have to be very cautious that our tools don't have that, that they become so complex that you need a two-year course before you can do stuff. Personally, I do a lot of quick sketching in PowerPoint, but I do it in a way that I hand-draw the stuff by tablet PC rather than use any of the geometry, and I'll just quickly do that because it has the same ease that HyperCard used to have. That's gone. So I don't know if that helped answer the question, but it's, but the key message is in the book, and it's everything's best for something, worse for something else.
Thank you. I have a question. I have a client that basically there's a large portion of text to the application, and so in some ways it's obviously very attractive. So, but text, you're losing some of the functionality of the text browser, the fact you can't right click and open a new tab and that kind of thing, and also inline. How do you feel that text comes into play with Silverlight going forward and just keeping with that user experience? Is it looking to more like a hybrid solution, or is it going to be in the future more encapsulated all into the Silverlight app itself?
It's a tough question. I'm probably the wrong person to give you I'm not going to give you a technical answer because I wouldn't know what I say. I'd be speculating. So, but I'll talk to the issue of how to do this. And my sense is that the thing about text is, of course, it's about reading. And how we structure documents for optimal reading really depends on the nature of reading. I think one of the things when I look at ebooks, which is something that I've paid a lot of attention to, is there seems to be this naive model that reading consists of just transferring words from the page. It's a one-direction thing from the page to the eye. When, of course, that may be true when I'm reading a part of a romance or something that I'm just reading recreationally. When I'm taking notes, it's a different thing. I want a dictionary. If it's a report, I want to annotate and other times when I'm reading to extract material to paste into something as a quote in the document. Reading is very, very rich. And so the first thing is that how we think about handling text documents and the flow depends very much on the nature of the document, the nature of the reader, and the context. One of my favorite examples that I actually cut from my talk yesterday that I wanted to speak about is, you probably don't know this, but you probably didn't hear reviews like the New York Times Reader. There's a number of other newspapers who use the same basic reader. Did you know that's a Microsoft technology? That was developed by a guy named Michael. I'm having a lot. They'll come to me over the next time. But what he and the team did is they actually went through and just analyzed newspapers and how they structured and what's the flow. And the most fascinating thing about this for anybody who's in interactive and web, I think, because I always love to listen with my teams to have shared experience where we just grab a Friday afternoon and at lunch have a brown bag and we all do something. And the one thing is, everybody get a laptop and then meet the day's New York Times using an HTML browser and then load the New York Times reader and read it the same content that way. And you get a sense, same computer, same network, same content. And one's using the traditional browser, the other's using something that's tailored for newspapers, which witnesses sort of good running ads and text-based web pages. And then when I do that type of thing, then what I'll probably do is say the same thing. Go and read the Rolling Stone or Playboy on the Bondi stuff. So you now in your repertoire have at least three. Oh no, then get some things like PDFs. There's lots of journals and so on PDF. Have those four reading experiences. So I get four. Five is my magic number usually. And then make notes in the repertoire. Cluster them. What was the experience? For what? What's the nature of the content? And then look at other kinds of content with those techniques. And then I think you start to get the insights that will let you answer those questions yourself. And what should be driving it is nothing around Silverlight or Acrobat, right? What does the reader need? And if we don't give you the tools that deliver the experience you want to the client, A, don't use our tools, use somebody else's, but hopefully at the same time, write and say, hey, you know what? This is a really important application. Your stuff doesn't suit this because we're focused on this kind of reading and nobody's heard it. Why don't you add it? And then I absolutely allow you to drink. Right? Because that's but I think nobody should be blowing smoke here. We're at a period of transition. I'm Canadian and there's 500,000 trees a week that go into landfill sites to put newspapers out, although there's fewer now, the Seattle Post Intelligence was shut down yesterday from print. I think that ebooks are going to change, but I think it probably will be in the next 4 or 5 years as inappropriate to be seen reading the Sunday edition of New York Times on paper as it is today not to pick up your dog after it pukes on the sidewalk. Which 10 years ago it was unthinkable that I would be doing that every night, walking around with plastic bags, picking up after my dogs. Right? There's a cultural value change, and it's really important. But I collect books, I love reading. We've got to nail this, and I want to make sure authors get paid in the process, and I want to make sure that journalists get paid in the process. And I think all of that's part of the design. What do you have to try this with? What do people need? But what's the whole ecosystem? And that's the challenge. It's not about Silverlight. But hopefully Silverlight's part of the solution, if we get it right.
It's a linear way to go down the path. I would argue, at the risk of people throwing things at me, it is the approach that agile programming in RAD advocates and scrums and so on. I believe that is not a good way to get good design. I think the thing that's a value of agile programming is the scrums and the people talking. That's where the power comes. But it does not, and it cannot, my understanding as a computer science professor, lead to good architecture, much less good design. You have to, because you can't keep refactoring from scratch, you have to make commitments, you can't backtrack. That's just reality. So the question then would be, is there another way to approach it? And it doesn't say you go back to the old waterfall technique, but that you abandon the good stuff from Agile. But it says that you have to have a hierarchy of types of questions you have. The thing I working on right now is a study of the Seattle Public Library, which is a fairly major building that Brent Poolhouse's firm, the ISM Architecture, did in Seattle. And it turns out that Henry Hong Chung, who is the designer of my book, he's actually an architect who just happens to cycle with me, so he slummed and designed my book for me. But he did all the interior environmental graphic design on that, for that building. So we have a lot of access to insights on the whole design process. The important thing about that is that the design of the Seattle Public Library, this is true with almost any building, and by the way, buildings I think are important for us because they also involve high level of architecture, the architect, the creator, the design, as well as engineering, and then the construction, and engineering that designs that, the construction engineer, as well as the construction engineers. The design didn't finish until after the building had been delivered. Because it would be foolish to do the final detailing until you actually almost had the building finished, because no architect would presume, no matter how experienced they are, to be able to pre-visualize what it was like to see the interior in space. And so they naturally hold off on certain design decisions until they can inform that decision by where you are in the process. So this notion that all the design is done before you start engineering and then you do it is nonsense. What it is the high order bits, if you want to talk about it in design terms, the high order decisions are there before you start to build, or should be. You do not break ground for the foundation until you have down what it should be built. If it can be built, for how much, and how you're going to build it. No film is made that way, no building is built that way, all software is built that way. The thing I rant about is that the software industry, we decided for a project, and we assigned to the engineers and started building it from day one before we had this building the foundation, before we had any sense of design. And what I'd argue from that building one day is that they say, oh yeah, we've got this plan, here's some sketches and stuff like that. What I challenge you to do is look at the sketches that OMA provided in order to get the contract at the beginning. And those are the level of renderings that we have for software projects. What they output of design is the blueprints, not sketches. And that's what we forget. And by the way, the structural engineers were absolutely critical in the evolution of that thing from the sketch to the blueprint. So the challenge now is that, so quickly, I am trying to answer your question. There's a hierarchy of questions in the design. So the first thing you need to do in a project is not just look at different things, solutions and things like that, and what the critical design decisions are, but you need to have some kind of taxonomy of the problems in a hierarchy. What are the first order problems, second order, third order? And by the way, when you get down to the first order, that may repercolate. What's the second order? When you make the second order, that repercolates and you resort. So because of resorting, and so you start with nothing, generate a huge number of ideas, you converge. From there, and then you say, okay, we've got new questions. You expand again, you converge. But it's a saw like that. And it's this expansion contraction all the way down. You generate ideas and then you filter. This comes and the most important thing is in each case you look at least five. Now the second thing is that I think speaks to what I really think you're getting at is how do you make a decision? And that's where the creativity comes. So I'm going to come back to that if I don't just quote it, okay? But no matter how you came to the decision, the most important thing that you need to do, or we all need to do, but it's the least thing done, is that if we know, here's a decision point, is to absolutely capture and document the rationale for that decision. What were the considerations in terms of the pluses and minuses and what influenced that that led to us making this decision? That's a reason for that. Because in every project, you get to a point where somebody says, oh my God, maybe we should rethink that decision. Right? So if you can go back to that decision and then say, here's not just what the decision is, but here's why we made it. Now, have any of the factors that influenced that, us making that decision, have they changed significantly? And if they have not, then you have to ask yourself, well, so why are we thinking of changing it? But if the factors that were the determining factors for why you chose A instead of C have changed, then you maybe really, really, really should think about changing that decision. But if you don't have the design rationale, you haven't been very disciplined about what are our principles, that's the first thing we have, what are our design principles, what are the rules, and then what are the reasons on each decision, then I don't have that kind of structure. And one of the things I did in the book that I think is, I never planned it, but I realized when Henry, because he's absolutely the most creative person I've ever worked with, like one of the most, but we've been talking about all this stuff, and on the bikes, and pie in the sky, and for a couple of days, and decided to do it. And he gives me the spreadsheet of, and I decided to just reproduce an entire damn spreadsheet. It was a whole pipeline of the book process. And it basically was divided. Playtime, work time, delivered. Playtime, work time. So we knew exactly when we could be the harebrained, flaky, artsy-fartsy, hippie designer, and when we could be an accountant. The yin and the yang. And that notion of the discipline is the other part that we keep forgetting in the design process. And I think for some designers to just think, oh, we're just creative, let somebody else do the be disciplined. It's crap, you're not a professional. That's okay. Go to art school, don't go to design school. There's a difference. Even in art, it's not that acceptable. But as a designer, man, you'd have to meet deadlines or you're going to lose the respect of all the engineers and your funders, and you're not a professional. And you cannot need to rely on a muse, an inspiration. If you're a professional, you can do competent work. If you're hungover, jet-lagged, and in the midst of a divorce, you can still concentrate and do your job, or you're not a professional. But when you are inspired, that's when the magic happens. But your professional stature should not depend on magic or that. That's just the bonus. But I want to come back to what the social, how do you make a decision? I hate trying to define what design is, but I'm going to do that. And the first half of the book is I'm not going to do it. The second half, somewhere through it, I sort of say, okay, I'm going to break down. Here's what I think it is. Design is choice. And that's my really short stance here. And there's only two places where creativity enters into this. One, the creativity you bring in generating the things from which you choose. So, if design is choice, I have to do design. What, for this question, what are the possible solutions I can come up with? And that's where lateral thinking and out-of-the-box thinking and, you know, all these things, techniques, you know, whatever, brainstorm, whatever. Let's build up the thing. And then the critical thing is ask yourself, if you need this discussion, you've got this big list, let's say, it's not about how many things I did. It's meaningfully distinct things. And when people brainstorm, they got all these different ideas. If you step back at one level of abstraction, you will see that half of them are the same thing, generically. They're just slight variations on the theme. So strip them out, cluster them. That's only one thing. I want five meaningfully distinct solutions. And the more creative you are, and the more technique you have, and the more experience you have as a group, the broader that will be. And that's the first place you could do. So that's the expansion part. Generate the ideas. And then the hairpin going the other direction is the second place where creativity. So that if the first place of creativity is the creativity you bring to generating a set of meaningfully distinct alternatives from which you choose, the second place for creativity is the creativity you bring and the insights you bring to generating the heuristics and the criteria that you use to make the decision, the selection. How do you narrow it down? And so the answer is, I can't give you a formula for how to choose once you generate it, because in fact, the way you choose is one of the most important and the, because by the way, you start with a gazillion ideas and you end up with one final design, right? So there's far more of the second kind of creativity than there is in the first, which is ironic, right? You, creative destruction and rejection is, and do it without pissing everybody off too, right? You need the social skills, but even with the right criteria. Design rationale is one of the most important things. But the types of things are, okay, come back to ebooks. Let's start with that, right? The notion, if I was making a decision about an ebook, if you didn't come up with the idea and say, well, they're all really equally good for the reader, but this one has the chance to have a financial model where authors can get paid that won't piss off the readers, but we'll look after the authors as well. That's going to win. Maybe. But if nobody had the wit to think about the poor authors or the journalists and was just thinking about the readers, then that factor wouldn't be in the evaluation criteria and we'd take plan D instead of your plan B. But somebody had to have that creativity. That's a creative solution. Right? And that's the kind of thing. And whenever I'm having meetings, and I don't think I talked about this yesterday, is that I'll regularly ask anybody who works with me, I'll regularly just say, okay, stop. What in God's earth gives us the arrogance to believe that our direct competitors, Google or Apple, aren't having exactly the same meeting right now? Look, they recruit from the same schools, they go to the same conferences, they read the same journals, they live in the same kind of house, they drink the same kind of beer, they're the same age. So, what the hell? What an arrogance would let you believe that they're not having the same meeting? And generally, the only reason I sometimes think maybe they're not is when we've asked that kind of hard question and then thrown out what we had in the board and had a whole other set standard of what was acceptable in terms of the things we've listed and the things to select from and the criteria with by which we made a selection. And that it's, you always have to check out. It's never business as usual. But it's a very different way than how we do software. But if we do that, and make sure there's somebody who's as equally creative, and I don't mean in the Enron sense, but as equally creative in business model ideas about business models and ways to monetize our things, and somebody who's one of the best engineers, but the most creative engineers there, helping you make these decisions, because they may have something that says, oh crap, I could build that for half the price, which means it's not just about that, the product could be there for, and oh, I could sell it to three different markets if it's half the price, so all of a sudden we quadrupled our potential revenue, right? So this comes back to this question about architecture, is that in software, we do not differentiate between the types of engineers that build things and the types of engineers at structural engineering. But I got to tell you, when Frank Gehry does a building, I know this because Henry has worked with Frank Gehry as well. This is the firm I worked with for a while, Bruce Mountain Design, before I came to Microsoft. He'll put on paper to, hey, here's the building, and somebody, the structural engineer, will say, Frank, you know, that won't stand up. It's not structurally sound. Or it costs so much that we can afford to build it. But I understand what you're trying to do. So what if I gave you this instead? Is that close enough? You have this kind of compromised negotiation. And all of a sudden, the financial person says, but holy crap, this is way too expensive. We can't afford that. But I see what you're trying to get at. So if we just added another floor to the building over here that we could, you know, rent out as retail, that would help finance it so we can afford it. Everybody wins. But you need those three components, business and technological. But notice, the person who's doing that business design isn't the one who sells it. The person who's doing the structural engineering is a different kind of engineer than the one that does the construction. And the architect isn't the one who's, you know, doing the interior design. But those things need to be done up front. And what's fascinating to me in software, what we call an architect is actually a structural engineer. And there is no architect. And therefore, there's no design. And therefore, we deserve what we get, which is basically stuff that is unworthy.
And the nice thing is, we're at a stage now where that's no longer separate. Because it's too expensive, it's too complex. And the after-sale support swallows up any profit you might make, because you built something without thinking, and now you don't have to crap it. And I'm not speaking Microsoft, I'm speaking as our industry as a whole. I'm overstating it to make a point, but we could do way, way, way better. And everybody will win. Our customers, our poor people are debugging this stuff, and the salespeople are going to sell it. Everybody will win. And the shareholders. That was a long answer to what you thought was when you said the question. But I think it gets to the essence of what this stuff's about, what the opportunities are.
So, at my shop, we have lots of properties, and we have a lot of discussions about user interaction on our site, and social type functions, and whether or not we should control those types of things. So whether that's in the context of one of the shows that we have, the context of a photo with an image gallery, or allow, so a specific example would be, say, like an image gallery. Do we have a comment on the gallery itself, or is all commenting related to an individual image? Or should that image be related to a larger context, or should it be an article or some descriptive introduction to the image? And generally just about whether or not we maintain users in the context that we present, or if we loosen up on that and have something more akin to an old-school message or that kind of thing which lacks context.
Yeah, I think the question has to do with, let's say you have a photo gallery. It's got to do with Latin. So it's annotation and tagging. And can I tag groups? How do you define the groups? Can I tag individual images? How does that fit into the search engine? How do you build a system to anticipate the types of clustering and different hierarchies that people might want to do, and then make it so it's not so complex that even though you can do everything you thought you want, it's not so complex and nobody does anything. And that's kind of where we often end up. The first thing I'll just say, obviously it's a hard problem, so I would lose all credibility if I had a candidate to say, here's the solution. But when I think about that, here's how I immediately are talking what I'm doing. I'm thinking about where I would go to collect things that would inform my thinking about the problem. And because I used to be a musician, and I started designing synthesizers and playing synthesizers back in the 60s. There was a period, I guess, in the late 70s when samplers started to come out instead of synthesizers. Cameras are samplers in the visual domain, as drawing as synthesis, right? And so you can synthesize sketches by drawing, or you can sample them by buying them on eBay or photographing them and collecting them and posting them out. So for me, the collecting of reference material is part of the sketching process. So the first thing that came to my mind, just maybe shows how pathetic my mind is, I was thinking about photosynth. So if you notice photosynth, because that was an interesting thing to me, because when you have a coherent set of images of the same thing from different angles, when you tag something in the photograph, it actually is attached to the content of the photograph, not to the photograph itself. And therefore, Notre Dame Cathedral and some of the sculptures above, if I put a tag on that sculpture identifying, you know, it's Mary Magdalene or whoever the hell it was, whoever had it was, you tag it once and it's tagged for all photographs that include Mary Magdalene in the shot. With a certain extension, there's a level of detail zoom factor, so you can in Z or Z in that country, you can say as I get to this level of detail, I open up even more. So the further away I get, in a certain perspective, the annotations disappear. So it's higher order, lower.
So this is a really interesting example that until Blaze did seed writing, and then the folks at research at the University of Washington did this Folio Vista, which if you haven't played with it, it led to DeepZoom and stuff like that. Again, I'm not pitching it, it's just that this was a new thing like visual language. It completely transformed my notion of what tagging meant. Now there's about geographical and content. And then I start thinking, are there other ways to sort things where you have that same coherence through spatial relationships, but not, but where it's not driven, but where it might be driven by something other than the geometry of the thing that's the subject of the shot. I don't even know what that question means, but the referencing channels me to pose the question that way. And then we'll talk about that, and either that will bring up some more ideas, or the idea might be dead end, but it triggers another avenue of inquiry. But so my best way to answer is to say this is the type of gymnastics as a designer, what I would immediately do, and which I started doing year after year, and I think the most important thing is if anybody came up with an idea, I'd register it, but I would not pursue that idea until I got 5-1 or 4-1, because we have to fight like hell against the inertia of our past history to already be laid, so the minute there's something that could even be viable, to just rush down that path. By the way, that'll get a design that works. It won't get, you make it the design right, it won't get the right design. And, does that help? Does that make sense?
Yes, I guess to go on a little bit, just an idea of how much context is important to user experience for when they're interacting.
How much context is experience? I have really strong feelings about that. That I in some ways have to fight because those strong feelings, either mean I see truth or it means I've got some biases that I've got to hold myself in check. I talked about Henry Dreyfuss yesterday. If you want to give yourself a treat, there's about 3 or 4 sites on the net that sell used books. One's Ape Books, ABE Books, the other's iLibris, and there's another one called, anyway, look up, try and get a first edition of Dreyfuss's book. His book's in the bibliography of my book, if you want to find the proper citation. I think it's 1951, it's called Designing for People. But try and get the first edition. It's the most beautiful piece of typography and design, of book design, that anything in my collection. And I bought and read every single book in the bibliography of my book. I really, really take my scholarship seriously. And that book is the one I would, of all the books in my library on design, that's the one I'd save at the house top. And because in that book he talks about persona. Everybody sort of says Alan Cooper invented persona. He might have made the word popular, but the concept of universal persona, Dreyfuss was doing in the 30s. He didn't publish it until the 51. But read that book. If you didn't already have my book, that's the book to buy. It's just great. Now that having done that, I think the thing about persona is important. Know your users, know your customers. But in my next column in Business Week, so it's timely that you ask the question, I've been playing with this notion, I've talked about this notion of, it's a stupid word, but place on it, that it's as important in design to character, if persona captures the canonical set of distinct types of user, or a critical mass of a canonical set, place on it, capture the canonical set of the basic places where interaction takes place. And I mean that in terms of social place as well as physical space. And really then the design space becomes a cross product of the context in terms of the physical and social location. And that includes the other technologies, the other artifacts that are there, as well as the geographical location. And then the social, right? This is really different, but it's not a big change, right?
huge difference, right? You're laughing. But we do that with our technology all the time, and the stupid technology doesn't know any of that. There's huge, huge meaning in distance, proximity, location, and we hardly ever take advantage of that. And that's one of the areas that I think, as we go through ubiquitous computing in the mobile, where things are going to be geotagged, not just in terms of now in Las Vegas, but in this room with this many people, and a few other things, that how can that inform the nature of the interaction? For example, right now, my mobile phone, why the hell do I have to turn it off? So that, which I did, and so on, right? But why do I have to do that? I should just do that because of where I am. That's a trivial example. But the exercise that I have students do when I'm teaching at their college in Toronto, which I do from time to time, is have them do a diary study over the course of 24 hours of every encounter they have with paper. And where they have to log every time they see, touch, or notice a piece of paper. They have to log the size, the location, the color, the content, what they think about who put it there, how long it's been there, etc., etc. And then we take that, and as a group, we just plaster it, set up on the foam board, all on the walls, we cluster them, and start to look at the patterns to try to understand that space. And here's why. Okay, it's fine. We launched Internet 8 today, right? And it's a browser, and Firefox is a browser, and so on and so forth. The differences among those browsers is minuscule. No, in some sense, who cares if Safari, you know, I got shot for Safari, but the difference between, it's in this perspective of this class of browser, Safari, Firefox, IE, and so forth, there's differences and there's advantages and disadvantages. That's fine. But that's nothing compared to the range of browsers such as they will be in 4 years' time. Here's how I think about it. The diversity of web browsers tomorrow is going to match the diversity of ink browsers today, where an ink browser is also known as paper. And if you think about it in those terms, then you see the reason for my exercise about logging everything with paper, because that will inform you about the diversity and range. They're all paper, they're all ink, but they're fundamentally, this change between me standing beside you is nothing compared to that range of diversity. And so for you as content creators or providers of the conduit for content, what does that mean? Because if there's that diversity, the problems we have now of having stuff that will work both on your desktop and your mobile is tiny compared to the range of different things that will be out there going forward. And that, in some sense, should be great news for you if we get it right, because it means, man, the opportunities for employment are just going to go through the roof. On the other hand, if you get it wrong, it's just going to be chaos and hell out there. And that's why, that's why we're doing IE8 now. But let's be real clear, we understand things are going to change, and that's what it's from us or anyone else. Getting this right, and that's also why the tools are trying to make it as easy as possible so that you can do the content once, system once, and then it's as transparent as possible when it moves off to different platforms of different form factors to avoid, so we have a chance to focus on getting it right rather than doing 10 different versions of the same thing just for different platforms, which is nice. It's just a totally discreet thing that we must be doing. But those are the kinds of things that keep me awake at night, but also say that in some sense the great thing is sketch most of that. That's great because it means now we can offload that stuff and work on it. Get to the next level of problems. And they're not going to go away. They're just going to get harder. Which is great if you have a job. That's why it is a great time to be a designer. That wasn't a job I was with. The opportunities are immense if we can get this stuff right. And for me, what was really exciting is that it was largely when I was asked to keynote at MIX, the Win 7 folks asked me, would I do a session here just to produce multi-touch on Win 7? Because I was doing some multi-touch back in 85, so I've got sort of slot history, and they wanted to show. And they actually canceled that session, but back when it was still on, I wrote back and said, well, I'll happy to do it, but if you could actually make the multi-touch stuff work equally well in Silverlight, then I'll put up the keynote. And, I'm not sure, but one person, a guy named Joe Smith, who's on the Silverlight team, an engineer, he didn't sleep, I don't think, for the last 5 weeks. No, he didn't have any weekends. And on Friday, just this last Friday, he finally sent me something and said, what about this? It's the first time I ever saw it. And you know, I've already written out what I'm going to do. And I just kept saying, keep on, Joe. I'll see what I can do. So he sent it to me. No promises, we'll see what we can do. And it was great. And so by Saturday, I sent it to Scott and stuff like that. And it was, everybody got really excited. And then Scott on Monday, no, almost on Tuesday yesterday, announced it and committed to put that in. And that's a case where somebody's a designer and motivated to do it. But the key thing is the reason that was so important to me, and I didn't care that, you know, well, I said my demo didn't work yesterday, it just made my demo the shortest ever, right? I had a world record now, the shortest demo. But all the stuff you saw yesterday, what was marvelous is it's the same old stuff you've seen on Jeff Hahn and all the Surface and stuff like that, but that it's on Silverlight, on rich interaction on that type of client. That's what caught my imagination. So what I was trying to do, and what I love, why I love my job and the people I work with, is they saw and they got it once it was working and were able to make fast decisions, which were the right decision. But it's, can we bring that kind of, as we get these low cost, low-end web applications or stuff like that, what that says to me is that we don't have to sacrifice the richness of interaction as we go to these other types of platforms. And that, you know, that Scott and the whole team, you know, reacted to that and recognized it was, and it just got pushed ahead by about a year before it was going to happen otherwise, just because of people stopping up. But for me, that what's really compelling is this notion, but that's not enough. Get the multi-touch in there on this rich web interaction. Then we start to tailor things into different types of delivery channels, like the New York Times reader or these types of readers. But that's just one class. And that's your job, because you have the expertise in that stuff. We don't. But it's that dialogue with you coming back and saying, hey, we need to do this, and do that, back and forth, where it gives me hope that we're going to make some progress pretty fast over the next couple of years. And the reason I was having a conversation is I can actually get that feedback sort of thing. So what should I ask for next year?
Just the question as an aspiring, experienced designer, graduating from here, just like for portfolio and resumes, and he's worked for companies too, I believe. It's like, how do you show that, as an experienced designer, how do you provide a portfolio process or tell people that you're a thinker, that you work with the process? I guess it's hard to explain. But the process of getting to the final design.
Yeah. So I'll tell you, if you were sending a resume to me, what would get my attention? Is that a good way to answer? And the answer is very similar to what I used to say to filmmakers when I was at Alias working in visual effects and animation. Everybody in film school, I'll do it by analogy, okay? Everybody in film school who's doing digital 3D and so on, they build a showreel where they're doing stuff that got as close to a Pixar type of animation as they could make it. With this beautifully rendered, you know, stuff, beautiful shaders, great motion. And you know what? I wouldn't recommend any of it. What I wanted to see was stuff that looked like crap with a thing. I did this in 25 minutes. Right? And Maddox. I could work through the shot.
That's what George Lucas does. He hires people. If you want to be in the front, or you're working directly with George, then you knock shots off like that. They're just pencil sketches and with rubber bands, and you know, some part is too finely rendered for my take on that. And I'd say the same thing here. If you can demonstrate a range of rendering techniques, from paper prototypes to quick animations and sketches and sort of stuff, that were clearly just sketches, but showed that you had facility in a number of different techniques, and with each one you said, this took 2 hours, this took 1 hour. I don't want to look at results, I want to look at, do you have this range of techniques, and how long it took you to do it is an indication of your fluency with that technique. That will get my attention. Oh, if you want to come in with one finished product with a beauty shot to show you can actually finish work, that's fine. But just be clear, everyone else who's applying for a design job is going to have all this beautiful, polished, finished stuff. And my sense is, I just assume anybody can do that. Why would you graduate? It's front end. So don't tell me about your process. I don't want to read documentation. Just show me these things and say, here's the funnel, this piece belongs here on the funnel, and this slot. Show me all that, when to use what, and then you have the techniques. And you show that to anybody who's worth working for. Anybody for whom that doesn't work, I don't think are worth working for. Unless your job is to go and educate them so they get it afterwards, right? If you want to be the evangelist. But and I'm overstating. I always get worried because I make mistakes with people think I'm not taking seriously my work. I understand that it's like purple, but I'm just trying to make a point. But that's what I work on. We got a microphone somewhere?
Yeah,
this is the last
question.
I've got another session. Okay. Sure. Thank you. In fact, I really enjoyed your point on true software architects as opposed to structural engineers. I've been saying that the whole week as well.
Good.
So I'm glad you messaged me.
Do you know Forbes keeps saying it will become a movement?
I hope so.
By the way, I think what this stuff is a movement. The thing that we should all be studying is how did our societal attitudes about stoop and scoop change? How did our societal attitudes about gender-neutral language change? How did all our attitudes about smoking change? How did our attitudes about drinking and driving? It was always illegal if people did it. How did that change? Right? All of those things happened by a social movement that was done by design, by concerned people. Right? We can do the same thing as a community about design. It's just more of the same. So I digress.
No, please, go on. My question, though, is that I come from the Flash background,
yep.
Years and years of professional interacting. Starting off in those early days where it's more like clay, you had to do everything from scratch, but really fast, really iterative and expressive. You get too big, it starts falling down.
Yep.
For the past year and a half, I've moved over to Microsoft staff and the experienced architect in that field. One of the biggest challenges in educating the Microsoft community is that with the strong, robust, component-based mindset, you have this great part in your book that I was reading this weekend, where you talk about sketches, and I never, sketches of course, but you draw a sketch, but then you start reading your sketch, and you read things that you consciously didn't know you were putting in there, and it has this, that's very, very hard to do when you're coming from a component-based mindset, because you don't have those happy accidents anymore. So how do you address that?
That's why I hate programming or going too deep, too fast. The things you're leading to is that, I talk about a couple of things. There's no such thing as high fidelity and low fidelity rendering. There's only correct fidelity, right? And you must not put a single detail in that's not required for the purpose. So you draw a car, you just have this concept of the shape, and you paint it red. I guarantee you that the design director in the review is going to say, I don't like that shade of red. Why don't you make that? And you're going to say, well, that doesn't matter. It just sits there. No, the director's not wrong. You're an idiot. Why did you make it red? Why did you give it a color at all? If the color doesn't matter, why is it there? It's your incompetence or my incompetence. Right? I shouldn't have made it red. It's my own fault. I won't do that again. Nothing there. The point I made there is that these renderings, especially the sketches, have to be like Swiss cheese. You have to leave room, like holes, for the imagination. If you specify, sketches are not to specify, they're to be a catalyst for ideas. If you fill everything in, there's no
it's an insult. If I fail again, it's an insult to you because I've left no room for you to fill in what you saw in your mind's eye that I never saw. It's not my sketch. It's our sketch. It's a social thing that ends up on the wall. And you want to leave everything unspecified if it's not critical to the question you're asking or what you're trying to explore. And so the question there was, with some of these component-based things and some of these digital technologies, they're too damn smart for their own good, and they start to fill in stuff that fill in the holes. So now we've got cheddar instead of Gruyere or Emmental, right? And so we've shut down the conversation because there's too much detail. And the hardest thing for us to do is to discipline ourselves to not be clever, to not show off, and to use the eraser better than we use the lead on the pencil. Leave the holes. And the only way we're going to control that is in our crits, within the studio, within our group, that we really keep each other honest that way. And point that out. And then part of the crit can be, the sketch is up there, redo it, and lower and lower resolution to get to the right place. Take the others, why do we make a mistake? Let's give them labels, put them up there, no, 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 none of this, tear them down, and then have the conversation. And that exercise will help. And that's the best I can say. Choice of tools is really going to bias those types of behaviors, and so some tools are going to require far more vigilance than others. And maybe therefore they shouldn't be used at that point. That's the best I can say. I've got to run. Thanks a million, and I'll do my best to answer emails and stuff like that. They're just grabbing the halls today or tomorrow, but I've learned a lot just from the nature of the questions. Thank you very much.